From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Attorney General Bill Barr is being questioned about the Mueller report by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Democrats are critical of how Barr framed the report's conclusions. Republicans are critical of the FBI's handling of the investigation. We'll hear some of the most important exchanges. They come up right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. Attorney General Bill Barr is addressing the Senate Judiciary Committee, answering questions about the Mueller investigation, as well as his four-page memo, which summarized the conclusions of the Mueller report. We're going to get into that momentarily. Just want to let you know what else is on tap. The city of L.A. and Waze have apparently reached an agreement to share information and to get commuters off of some of those narrow, hilly streets they use as pass-throughs to avoid congested freeways. We'll also talk about, in this era of peak TV viewing, how it's the old shows that are the backbone of Netflix's actual viewership. But we begin with some examples from Barr's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, the Democrat, asked Barr why he previously denied knowing that there were concerns in a Mueller team letter about how Barr had summarized the report.
My understanding was his concern was not the accuracy of the statement of the findings in my letter, but that he wanted more out there to provide additional context to explain his reasoning on why he didn't reach a decision on obstruction.
I'll just say this, Mr. Barr. If you received a letter from Bob Mueller a few days after your March 24th letter, it was clear he had some genuine concerns about what you had said and done to that point. Can we move to another topic?
Yeah, his concerns was he wanted more out. And I would analogize it to this. After a months-long trial, if I wanted to go out and get out to the public what the verdict was pending preparation of the full transcript, and I'm out there saying, here's the verdict, and the prosecutor comes up and taps me on the shoulder and says, well, the verdict doesn't really fully capture all my work. How about that great, cross-examination I did, or how about that third day of trial where I did that? This doesn't capture everything. My answer to that is I'm not trying to capture everything. I'm just trying to state the verdict.
No, you just absolutely used the word summarize, though, in your letter.
Summarize the principal conclusions.
Principal conclusions, which most people would view as a summary.
So there you hear the kind of hair splitting going on back and forth from the Senate Judiciary Committee members and the Attorney General with us to talk about some of the themes that have arisen over the course of the morning. Bloomberg Politics editor Anna Edgerton. Anna, good to have you with us again.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So let's start out with this issue over the Mueller letter that we learned about yesterday. I believe it was the Washington Post that first reported on this. But this where Mueller expressed concerns about the contextualizing of Barr's four-page memo. How much of that has taken up the questioning so far from Democrats?
Well, that was a great clip to play because that really does kind of represent the back and forth that we've had so far this morning. There has been a lot of concern expressed to William Barr about the way that he characterized the Mueller report. And the whole problem is we had this very extensive, almost two-year investigation that ended up taking more than 400 pages to completely lay out in the full version. And then for Bill Barr to present that in a four-page summary obviously was incomplete. So the concern is, and you've heard this expressed from Democratic senators today, how that was characterized and what he chose to include and what he chose to omit.
Mm. Barr's memo was essentially about whether the Justice Department would proceed with charging President Trump out of what came out of the report. Have Democrats gotten more specific about what they think is the daylight between how Barr characterized the Mueller investigation and what the 400 plus pages disclose about the findings?
Absolutely, and we've definitely seen that come out more since we've gotten the redacted version of the complete Mueller report. And there are really two areas that Democrats have focused on. One is the fact that, you know, Bill Barr said there was no collusion, so to speak. Well, collusion is not a legal term. There was no criminal conspiracy. But Mueller's report does detail a lot of communication between members of the Trump campaign and people affiliated with the Russian government. So while that might not have risen to the level of criminal conspiracy, there were connections that Democrats say merit further investigation. The other one is on the issue of obstruction of justice. And Special Counsel Robert Mueller laid out at least 10 episodes that could have constituted obstruction of justice. And he specifically said that he wanted to leave that up to Congress to decide. Well, Bill Barr, with the help of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, said that they didn't think that amounted to obstruction of justice. So the concern from Democrats in Congress is why that conclusion was reached before Congress had the opportunity to see the episodes that Mueller detailed in his more complete report.
And I guess I'm confused about that because, first of all, there would be a decision of the Attorney General as to whether they're going to take any legal action. And then the action would move to the House, where they would have a determination to make based on the results of Mueller's investigation, what, if anything, they chose to do based on that. So are Democrats saying that what Barr was arguing in that memo was that Congress should just leave it alone and not do anything? Is that what they're arguing? I'm a little confused.
Right. Well, part of the question comes down to what actions can be taken against a sitting president. And Mueller seems to be respecting Department of Justice practice that you don't indict a sitting president. So if you can't indict the president, you leave it to the political body, in this case Congress, to decide whether or not the president committed actions that should merit some further response. If he can't be indicted, he can be impeached. Now, the standard for impeachment is high crimes and misdemeanors, which is a very vague standard, and it really depends on a political decision, not a judicial decision on whether or not that did in fact take place.
Here's another exchange. This is from Democratic Senator from Rhode Island, Sheldon Whitehouse, asking the Attorney General about why he used the word spying, referencing Department of Justice activities as part of the Mueller probe.
You used the word spying
mm-hmm.
about authorized DOJ investigative activities.
Are you talking about my testimony before
yes.
the House Appropriations?
Yes.
Okay.
In the entirety of your previous career in the Department of Justice, including as Attorney General, have you ever referred to authorized department investigative activities officially or publicly as spying? I'm not asking for private conversation.
No, I'm not going to abjure the use of the word spying. I think, my first job was in CIA, and I don't think the word spying has any pejorative connotation at all. To me, the question is always whether or not it's authorized and adequately predicated spying. I think spying is a good English word that, in fact, doesn't have synonyms because it is the broadest word incorporating really all forms of covert intelligence collection. So I'm not going to back off the word spying, except I will say I'm not suggesting any pejorative, and I use it frequently, as do media.
When did you decide to use it? Was it off the cuff in the hearing that day, or did you go into that hearing intending to use the word spying?
It was actually off the cuff, to tell you the truth, and when he challenged me and said, "Do you want to change your language?" I was actually thinking, like, what's the issue? I don't consider it a pejorative. But frankly, we went back and looked at press usage, and up until all the FOIA outrage a couple of weeks ago, it's commonly used in the press to refer to authorized activities, such as referring
to the FISA court. But it's not commonly used by the department.
What?
It is not commonly used by the department. My time is
commonly used by me.
This feeds into Democrats' concerns about the use of that term that it potentially sullies what the FBI was involved with in carrying out its investigation to look into potential links between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives. With us from Bloomberg Politics editor Anna Edgerton, have there been multiple instances where Democrats have used this similar theme to attempt to portray Barr as currying favor with the president or prejudging how the investigation was carried out?
Right. Well, there's two things I would really pull from that clip that you played. And one would be the fact that Democrats are using this as an example of how Barr has characterized, if not misled people about what was in Mueller's report and the kind of the activity that led to that investigation. He might say that spying is not a pejorative word, but it is used in a very pejorative way in conservative media. So when you say media, that's one thing that's been difficult about this hearing right now is both senators and Barr are referring to media as a monolith. Well, the way that conservative cable news or conservative talk radio presents what has happened thus far is very different than the way that other cable news networks would present it, which is also very different than the way print news media would present it. So there's kind of been a back and forth on the role of the media in this. The other thing to pull out of that clip is how much Republicans on the committee, especially the committee chairman, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, have fixated on the origin of the investigation of the Trump campaign. And this comes back to the FISA warrant that allegedly authorized the initial monitoring of the communication between the Trump campaign and Russia. There are concerns from conservatives, from Republicans, that this was not warranted, that it was an illegal use of DOJ resources to monitor the Trump campaign, and they've been calling for an FBI investigation into that. So Graham said, as far as I'm concerned, the Mueller report is done. This chapter is closed. What we need to do is investigate the FBI action that led to the monitoring of this in the first place.
Let's hear from Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, asking the Attorney General Bill Barr about Robert Mueller not reaching a decision on whether President Trump obstructed justice.
As to obstruction of justice, were you surprised he was going to let you decide?
Yes, I was surprised. I think the very the function he was carrying out, the prosecutive and investigative and prosecutive function, is performed for the purpose of making
that. How many people did he actually indict? Do you know?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
So he actually has the ability to indict if he wants to. He's used that power during the investigation. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the other thing that was confusing to me is that the investigation carried on for a while as additional episodes were looked into, episodes right, involving the president. And so my question is, why were those investigated if at the end of the day you aren't going to reach a decision on them?
And we don't know what Mueller's response would be to that, Anna. Do we know if he's going to sit down before one of these congressional committees and talk about his reasoning?
There's certainly been calls from that, especially from Democrats, and their reasoning for that is because they want to hear directly from Mueller what he intended with a lot of the research that was in his report. They don't want to hear it filtered through Barr, filtered through the attorney general who was appointed by President Trump. They want to hear it directly from the person who oversaw the investigation. And Barr did, the Department of Justice has agreed to let Mueller testify, but there's been no agreement thus far on what the date would be or under what circumstances he could appear before Congress.
And there was a question that was asked about Don McGahn, whether he would testify about his tenure as attorney inside the Trump administration, and the question whether President Trump would allow him to testify about any of that or whether he would invoke executive privilege and that would be a drawn out fight. Did we learn anything more about that, Anna?
Yeah, Don McGahn is kind of emerged as a really interesting figure in this whole episode, because one of his interactions with President Trump was one of the examples that Mueller cited as possible obstruction of justice when Trump allegedly told McGahn to tell Rosenstein to get rid of Mueller. And so bringing McGahn before Congress and hearing from him what he thought the president's intent was would actually clear up some of these questions. So that's been the reasoning from Democrats to get him into some of these committees to testify. It's not clear whether or not they can still invoke executive privilege to prevent McGahn from testifying, since they did waive executive privilege at other instances in this whole investigation.
We're talking with politics editor at Bloomberg, Anna Edgerton. Let's go back to Republican Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina senator, who asked Barr about the extent of foreign interference that we might expect in 2020.
As to where we go forward, as to how we go forward, would you recommend that this committee and every other committee of Congress do our best to harden our infrastructure against future Russian attacks?
Absolutely, yes.
You think Russia is still up to it?
Yes.
You think other countries may get involved in our elections in 2020?
Yes.
So you would support an effort by Congress working with the administration to harden our electoral infrastructure?
Yes.
Is that one of the takeaways of the Mueller report?
Yes.
Lindsey Graham and Bill Barr in conversation. This is the Senate Judiciary Committee where the testimony took place today. Anna Edgerton, are the expectations this is going on all day? And has Barr agreed to talk before any House committees?
That's a really interesting question that came up today in a House Judiciary Committee hearing where they were trying to set the terms under which Barr would testify. The Department of Justice has said that they didn't want Barr to be questioned by committee lawyers, that they just wanted the members themselves to be able to ask questions. So in the House Judiciary hearing today, they set the rules for Barr's testimony, which is supposed to be tomorrow, to actually allow the committee's lawyers also to question Barr. It's unclear whether or not he'll show. If he doesn't show, there's a possibility that the House Judiciary Committee would subpoena him to force him to appear before Congress.
Anna, thanks very much. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Anna Edgerton, Bloomberg politics editor, joining us on Air Talk. It's 89.3 KPCC. The L.A. City Council's voted unanimously to partner again with Waze to try and get around the problems of residential streets being clogged with cut-through commuter traffic. This is particularly a problem in hillside communities with narrow and very steep streets. Residents complain not just about the noise or difficulty about getting out of their driveways, but cars parked on the street that have been sideswiped, large vehicles that have used Waze that should never have gotten onto those streets in the first place. So with us to talk about what this sharing of information might bring in the way of residential relief is L.A. City Council member Paul Krikorian. He represents the San Fernando Valley District 2. Councilman Krikorian, good to have you with us today. So what kind of information here is going to be shared?
Excuse me?
What kind of information is going to be shared?
Well, all of that is still up for discussion with the app companies. But my priority is to make sure that before we enter into any data sharing agreement, the app companies have to understand that they are causing real world impact in neighborhoods throughout Los Angeles. And we can't be in a situation where the city is providing data to these companies that they're profiting from, and in return, they're ignoring the real world impact of the use of their applications. And that's what's happening right now. So I'd like to see some real effort by these companies to take into account the horrendous consequences that neighborhoods throughout Los Angeles are suffering from because people are being routed in the ways that you described in your opening onto streets that just aren't designed for that level of traffic.
So specifically, what do you want Waze to do? Some of those very popular residential cut-throughs, do you want them to remove those streets from results on Waze so that people aren't directed there?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, where streets are local streets designated as local streets in our mobility plan, I don't think that they necessarily need to be entirely removed from the apps, but certainly when there's minimal time savings, it would be better for the apps and better for the neighborhoods if traffic is routed into the street, into the non-local streets, the feeder streets and otherwise, so that they aren't having that adverse impact. But really, the consequence to the user is de minimis. It's a matter of seconds or, right now they don't do that. Right now they go to the most, what they consider to be the most time efficient route, regardless of the impacts on the neighborhoods. And that's just wrong. So that's number one. Number two, there are all sorts of special circumstances that come up. Times when there's a special event, there may be an evacuation in an area. Those are situations where we want to provide that data to the app companies, but then they need to, in real time, route traffic around those circumstances, because we've had situations where a neighborhood is being evacuated and these app companies are literally routing traffic into that area because they're showing it as being filled with clear streets because people are being evacuated.
Well, I was thinking of that big fire in the Sepulveda Pass, what was a couple years ago? And that's kind of circumstance you're talking about, right? Where everybody's being evacuated and Waze is still dumping people into those streets.
Exactly. It's a real threat to public safety. And so if we're going to have a data sharing partnership, it needs to be a real partnership, which means that these companies need to take into account the public safety concerns, the quality of life concerns that people legitimately have. And we can do that in a way that still preserves the value of using mapping apps.
We're talking with Los Angeles City Councilman Paul Krikorian about the negative impact of Waze sending commuters onto narrow, hilly residential streets to pick up a few minutes on their daily commute. I'd like to hear from you if you're a resident of one of those areas that's been most heavily affected. How do you deal with it? How has it changed your life? What would you like to see happen with how Waze directs people to the streets or doesn't? We're at 866-893-KPECC. Also, if you're someone who regularly uses those Waze residential cut-throughs, I'd like to hear about what you see as the benefit. Do you think it is just a few minutes that you pick up or considerable time by taking those residential streets in lieu of the freeways? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Thomas in Beverly Hills, your thoughts about whether some of these streets ways should avoid sending people onto them.
Hey, Larry. Yeah, so my thought is that if residents don't want the public to use their streets, they can petition to have those streets made private and accept the financial responsibility associated with maintaining those streets. These are public roads. Waze is a great tool. I use it myself. I don't like people driving around my Beverly Hills neighborhood necessarily, but I'm willing to accept the consequences because the public, including myself as a taxpayer, are covering the cost of the roads and the maintenance.
That's very difficult in Los Angeles to make a street private. There have been communities that have tried to do that and offered to take on the expense, and the council has not approved that. So would you want to see that as an easier thing to go through to make streets private?
Yeah, sounds great. And if it's too difficult to overcome, then the residents, you know, clearly weren't committed to the idea of getting that street private. It's obviously possible, and Waze is a new technology, so maybe the barriers to having streets made private and taking the financial responsibility need to be eased. But to me, that's the issue, not necessarily people overcrowding the roads.
Thomas, appreciate your call. Chris in Hollywood, wondering if the city's planning to share information like freeway entrance closures with app companies so that they don't route users there. That would be very helpful. That would probably be Caltrans information. Councilman Krikorian, do you know if that information is shared in real time?
I don't. That is a Caltrans issue, but that's obviously, look, I think one of the best uses of these apps is in choosing freeway routes. I use it for that purpose all the time, but that's an entirely different set of issues than the one that we're talking about, where we're impacting substandard streets with blind curves, sometimes with no sidewalks, kids riding their bike or having to walk in the street because there aren't sidewalks, and you have, you know, 100 cars going through, you know, with using these apps that maybe aren't familiar with the neighborhood, aren't familiar with the curves. They're looking at their app. They're, you know, speeding because they're late. Those are the problems that we're trying to address, not necessarily the freeway situation, although that's an important part of this equation as well.
Bong Bong tweets at AirTalk, so the app, which helpfully directs vehicles around heavy traffic, will now keep them in heavy traffic? That right there is California politics in a nutshell. From UC Berkeley's Institute of Transportation Studies, the chair and director of the Institute, Alexander M. Bayan, thank you very much for being with us, sir. Are other cities dealing with this issue, or is this essentially only in greater Los Angeles issue?
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for having me on the show. This is a worldwide problem. We at Berkeley have actually gathered information about dozens of cities in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, and many other places. So it's really a cancer that is growing globally. And for that, I really want to thank KPCC, the councilman, the listeners, and the callers for raising the awareness, because selfish routing, which is the way it's actually referred to in computer science, which is what these apps are doing, is just bad for society. Many of you probably have seen the movie A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe. And despite all the claims that these companies might make about app providers, there's actually a Nobel Prize that proved that selfish routing is just bad. And what we're witnessing today in Los Angeles is just an instantiation of something which is a worldwide problem.
What would be your fix?
And I'm sure we'll talk later about this in the show, but the point is that we need to have a more fair flow allocation process so that the burden is shared by the entire network, not just by specific neighborhoods.
And how would you do that in a way that balances the neighborhood perspective with the commuters, where time is money?
So this is the difficulty that you mentioned earlier in the show, is that you can do things on the city side or you can do things on the company side. And, of course, the company side is much harder. On the city side, the problem is that we don't have laws or we don't have regulations that allow to do that, like road user charge. You know, we're just at the beginning in California, or even access restriction, which is also complicated, like the fact that, yes, you might prevent some streets from through traffic. And that's why I think we need to push an agenda, a statewide agenda, so that we solve that problem for all of California, not just LA. I mean, it's very hard in LA, but it's also very hard here in the Bay Area. And there's an even harder policy that maybe is a federal policy that could be looked at as well, is like, how do we actually entail the companies to split the flows optimally? Because right now, selfish routing essentially gives everybody the selfish route, but there's no notion that, you know, if you send 30% of the traffic one way and 20% the other way, everybody would benefit. The technology is there, but there is no framework that the state or the government, the federal government, could use to actually make this happen at the state or nation level.
We're talking with Alexander Bayan, who's with the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Berkeley. He directs and chairs the Institute. We're taking your calls. Also with us, the co-editor of Streets Blog LA, Damian Newton. Damian, what can you add to this you know, challenge of neighborhoods versus commuters?
Well, I approach this from two angles. First, I'm a father who walks with his kids to school every day, and we definitely have seen over the past couple of years an increase in cut-through traffic. And a lot of times the drivers of those, especially if they're getting their directions from an app to avoid the major streets, are the ones that are most likely to be the ones that are driving a little faster than maybe they should, or, you know, paying closer attention to their phone than they should. And that creates a safety hazard for everybody, the driver in the car and obviously the people walking on the street. And we have there's no distinction in a lot of these programs for schools, for pickup and drop off hours at schools or those sorts of things. And so if those routes are being treated the same as all the other ones, it does create a public safety hazard in those areas. A second thing we've been seeing is these apps have made it harder for us to do the types of progressive transportation planning that has been working in all parts of the world. There's been a big controversy near where I live on the west side about Venice Boulevard and a road diet that went in about a year and a half ago, and well, almost 2 years ago now, and the impacts it had. And one of the reasons that there was such an uproar was almost immediately there was huge amounts of cuts through traffic on the local streets. And the project was supposed to be designed to just slow down traffic in a very dangerous part of the city. But what happened is a lot of those cars, a lot of that traffic, instead of just going through a slowdown for that 1 mile area, were routed onto local streets and sometimes routed back onto Venice for more than just a mile. And so while it may have made that section of Venice safer, they've created a different problem of a lot more cut through traffic. And this isn't something that we've seen at nearly the same level with road diets and sort of a ways world.
Hold that thought. We're talking with Damian Newton, co-editor, Streets Blog LA. Also with us, Paul Krikorian, LA City Council member. Councilman, I know that you have to leave. We have a bunch more calls we're going to take as a part of our conversation here. But so what's the next step in this relationship with Waze?
Well, the council has, as of yesterday, set out a framework of the kinds of things that we would want to have negotiated into any data sharing agreement. The next step will be to move forward with the app providers and see whether there's interest in this. I should say that it's very much in their interests to cooperate with the city on this, because there's all sorts of data that the city has available that would make those applications more efficient and more effective. But they have to be our partner in this. And, Damian Newton suggested a couple of other examples that I wanted to mention as well, which are really appropriate, like the school zones. We have school zones throughout the city that, have parent drop-off at the very same time that our streets are congested. And so these apps are directing people towards schools where kids are trying to cross the street and so on. It's just, there are so many examples of that, of ways that we can enhance pedestrian safety, enhance bicyclist safety, and enhance the efficiency of the use of our roads for drivers if they would just sit down and cooperate with us as real partners instead of committing themselves to the absolute selfish routing algorithm that will produce the quickest means of a car getting from point A to point B. That shouldn't be the only consideration.
Councilman, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Los Angeles City Councilman Paul Krikorian, District 2 of the Valley, is his district, and he introduced the motion to study the negative impact of Waze putting traffic into residential neighborhoods, often in hillside communities, but not exclusively. There are also areas of the flats of L.A. where cars pour into residential communities and pose a concern. We're taking your calls. We'll continue with that coming right up after our update. I'd like to hear part of town you're in, what's been the effect of Waze channeling commuters into your streets. Also, those of you that use Waze to go through residential areas, how do you balance the effect of that with the time element of trying to get to work in a timely manner? 866-893-KPCC. So many good comments to share right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Liz tweets at AirTalk, I fully agree the apps are a problem. I do veterinary house calls for a living. I refuse to use Waze because I don't like driving through residential streets with poor visibility because of parked cars on both sides and kids and pets nearby. We're talking about the challenges for residential communities with cut-through commuter traffic, particularly in many of the areas with narrow streets, finding it tough to accommodate parked cars as well as backed up traffic each morning and evening. Paul at Mount Washington says one of the big problems with Waze, it often asks you to make a left turn from a stop sign onto a busy, wide street. And that really holds up traffic. Paul, you are absolutely right. And I can never figure out in a major metropolitan area where there's tons of feedback available to traffic and navigation apps, why they would not know that it's not a signal, that it's a stop sign, and as a result, very difficult to make a left turn across all those lanes of traffic. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Shelley in Mar Vista, you're on Air Talk. What do you see in your neighborhood?
Hi, yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm so passionate about this issue, so I really appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah.
I live on a residential street that has 6 4-year-olds and 2 1-year-olds and in Mar Vista. And, of course, those 4-year-olds were once 1-year-olds and 2-year-olds, you know, who don't, you know, have exactly the control to, you know, not run in the street when we tell them to or whatever. Of course, we always have a close eye on them. But my point being that there are so many, many cars that drive down the street at like 40 miles per hour. I see them starting at 4 p.m. and they go so fast. The other day I was just trying to cross the street to drop off something at a neighbor's house, and I was holding my 4-year-old's hand and holding my 1-year-old. And there was at least 4 cars just from walking across and back and forth that were driving so fast and were all on their phone, not even looking up, didn't even see me. And it's so alarming and frustrating because, you know, they're all being directed by Waze because our street is a cut through from Washington to Centinella. And it is really frustrating.
Yeah, because all the backup on the larger streets that are surrounding you. And Shelley, it's not just, I understand your concern about Waze sending people down the street, but then the rudeness, obliviousness of the drivers who are using the street. Thank you for sharing your experience as a resident. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Erica in Culver City. Erica, you use Waze to cut through residential areas?
Yes, I do. And one time it took me through the Hollywood Hills and tried to take me down a private road. And then I got stopped at a gate, but the road was so narrow, I couldn't turn around. And I was trying to figure out what to do. And fortunately, the owner was coming home and was able to open the gate so I could turn around in his driveway. And then they tried to do that to me a second time on another occasion, but I had the sense to turn around before it sent me there.
So given those two experiences, are you now more skeptical about using Waze if you don't know the specific streets?
If I'm going through the Hollywood Hills, yeah, I'll usually just ignore it and go a different way. Still use it, but I try to use my common sense about whether or not I should take their direction exactly.
All right. Well, Erica, I appreciate it. Natalie in North Hollywood says, I'm a resident of Krikorian's district. Nothing has been done to make things better, but I have an idea about the school zone issue. In other areas of the country, you have to go 25 miles an hour. The police wait and watch. People have learned over time they have to obey the speed limit. It works really well. So enforcement, she thinks of, and lower speed limits would be a way of combating this. Alex in Venice Beach. What have you seen with cut-through traffic in your neighborhood?
Hi, good morning. We have just an insane amount of cut-through volume in a street just off of Abbot Kinney in Venice where it's got a blind corner, it's got no sidewalk, it's got no walkways, and it's literally like a daily life-threatening experience with little kids. And there are tens, if not close to 100 kids and parents a day walking to the public school hereby, which is Coeur d'Alene. But it's insane that just nothing's been done about it, just even providing walkways or any sort of safety measures.
So would you, if you were a city council member, would you be pushing ways to block off certain streets from the results and not use those? Would you be pushing for mitigation, like you're talking about sidewalks or safety barrier? What do you think is a realistic solution?
Well, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. I think number one, I mean, in our instance, there's a couple measures the city could take, which is like a left turning arrow off of Washington on Abbot Kinney. This is a very high traffic throughput from going from south to north. People commuting into Santa Monica. And if they had an arrow just on Abbot Kinney, I mean, that'll solve most of the pain here. But I think it's a combination of city response in addition to ways, I think, working with the city and understanding that this is, you know, a school hour Monday through Friday. And this particular cut-through is just not teed up for that level of volume.
All right, Alex, I appreciate your call. In Venice Beach, 866-893-KPCC. Let me go back to UC Berkeley Institute of Transportation Studies Director Alexander Bayan. Are these apps set up, Waze or any others, that they could be sensitive during certain times of the day to parents dropping off students, to other sorts of factors like that, to take that into account along with traffic flow?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a technologically not even in reach. It's already a feature. It just needs to be enabled. For example, in the Bay Area, when they replaced the old Bay Bridge with a new Bay Bridge, you know, for a few days, the routers figured, I mean, they knew, and they essentially never routed people through the bridge because the bridge didn't exist because it was being replaced. So this notion of geofencing and even have a temporal aspect to it is really something that is that can be done very, very easily. From a technological standpoint, obviously, as we heard from the listeners, as we heard from the councilman, the difficulty is to put the proper incentives in place or maybe even regulation in place so that they do it.
All right. Let's take another call. This is from Philip in Midtown Los Angeles. Interesting to hear so many communities are affected by this. Philip, what do you see in your neighborhood?
Hey there. Well, here's my story. I'm on a street immediately adjacent to the Wilshire Division Police Department, very close to Venice and La Brea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually on a small street, north-south street, right next to the property of the police and the city called Highland Avenue, which we all know from Hollywood. Nobody even knows it goes down this far south. And it's just a small street between two major streets, between Pico on the north and Venice Boulevard on the south. So we have all this westbound traffic coming down Pico, and they see a long left-turn queue forming at La Brea, which is the next block west, to turn left there so they can go down to the 10 freeway. Oh, don't bother to get in that queue. Just turn left on this little street right here, Highland Avenue, and cut over to Venice Boulevard, where you can then turn left from there onto La Brea. And so our little quiet neighborhood has turned into a freeway on-ramp all the time. It's, you know, that is compounded by the fact that we always have traffic here northbound from the police department. When they go code 3, they use our little street, and we deal with that. Okay,
yeah.
That's what we do here. That's our way of helping.
All right. Philip, I appreciate you sharing the experience. I need to break, and we'll take more listener calls. So we're hearing from all different communities, Venice Beach, West Los Angeles, Mar Vista, Midtown Los Angeles, the Hollywood Hills, the Santa Monica Mountains, so many different areas, and of course, Echo Park, Los Feliz. We're talking about the cut-throughs that people use to avoid backed-up major streets and freeways. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Yesterday, the LA City Council unanimously approved working with Waze on sharing information, W-A-Z-E, the app that helps people avoid the most congested freeways and major streets, often taking the smaller residential arteries as a way to get around the city. But that, of course, has quality of life and safety impact on those very communities. We're talking about that. And if you use Waze or Google Maps or any of the other apps that try and find the quickest way for you to commute, What are the ways you balance those factors? Hans in Altadena says, I'm a parent of young children, so I appreciate road safety. I also spend 4 hours driving each day. When I use Waze or Google Maps, I try to be smart about when I take their recommendations for side streets. I don't get off Sunset for just 4 blocks, only to get back on it again. I also try to drive through every neighborhood as if it's my own. Hans, very responsible approach to it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Robert in Sherman Oaks says, in my neighborhood, there's signage that you can't drive the street between 7 and 9 in the morning. It's a shortcut to get to the Sepulveda Tunnel, but there's no enforcement. So even between 7 and 9 in the morning, people end up doing it, using that street in Robert's neighborhood. John in Hollywood says, these are all public streets. Why are people complaining? Why would Waze block something off just because it's an inconvenience for the people that live there? Let's talk to Greg in Silver Lake. Greg, you have an answer for John in Hollywood?
You know, I don't know, because I'm up in Silver Lake Hills. We have no sidewalks, parking on one side of the street with barely enough room for one car. And it used to be when I would time leaving to go to a place like Santa Monica for traffic. Now I have to plan on when I leave home because the traffic coming up the hill is 4 or 5 cars thick. You know, we live in an area that is not attuned for the traffic that is being applied to us. As far as the applications and stuff, I think one of the things they need to look at is, as I would recommend, is that they have 2 lanes or 1 lane each way for traffic, not where 5 or 6 people have to pull over to let 3 or 4 other cars come by. If they had a shortcut for the wider streets that had more flow versus the single mountainous streets or the residential streets, I think that would be an avenue out of a lot of this.
All right, Greg, I appreciate it very much. Let's see. Next is Eddie in Corona. I understand you drive for a ride-hailing service. You use Waze a lot?
Absolutely. I do it for both Lyft and Uber, and I use it almost extensively to do, you know, all my rides. So I'm very familiar with the Hollywood, Silver Lake, Echo Park area because there's so much traffic. You know, the point I want to make is Waze was actually, you know, created to help drivers like myself and regular commuters route around traffic. I understand the frustration of some of these homeowners, but, you know, they're, you know, one of your callers already point out, it is a public street. As you can imagine, doing what I do, I've been all over, including private gated communities. And just like your first, you know, prior caller said, maybe that's the way to go if they want to really fix the problem, to go ahead and put up, you know, privatize their streets and put gates.
Eddie, since you drive many more miles, it sounds like, than most of us, you drive full time for the two companies, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So you're driving a lot of miles every day. How reliable is Waze, in your view, for actually giving you the quickest route?
It's pretty reliable. It's my go-to because I've been doing this for about 2.5 years now. I'm somewhat familiar, and this is what I've found. For whatever reason, Waze does love to put drivers on the freeway, despite what people say. But I found that if I'm in a downtown LA or anywhere west of that, if I tap on the avoid freeway and take the local streets, I would say about maybe 50% of the time I will get to destination faster than having Waze route me on the 110, which is a parking lot all day long, or any of the other freeways.
Mm-hmm. All right, Eddie, appreciate it. Good to have a professional driver perspective. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tanya in West Hollywood says, in low-income neighborhoods, people don't have the time to complain about growing traffic. How do we avoid making this into a NIMBY issue that disproportionately impacts poor neighborhoods? So in other words, Tanya's concerned that if wealthier neighborhoods are able to have their streets removed or de-emphasized in Waze results, Where's that going to go? The traffic is going to go into the residential communities where people are not necessarily as organized or able to put the time into fighting that traffic growth. Alexander Bayan of UC Berkeley, your thoughts about that?
So I think that what's important is that the solution is not a solution that can be found in isolation. So if you have a city with the complexity of Los Angeles, there needs to be a master plan. That master plan would definitely be taken over by the agencies that oversee mobility in the region, so SCAC, Caltrans, LA Metro, and many others. And then I think what's important for this to work as a global solution is that the apps are then essentially an enabler of the cities. And the way it's going to work is that through some form of master planning, or what's sometimes referred to as a concept of operations in traffic, the apps need to be able to provide things like 30% of the flows going north to south will go this way, and the remaining 70% would go that way. That is something that the apps can do, but they need guidance from the public agencies, and of course, they need the incentive to do that, which I think can only happen with regulations. And that's if we want to be proactive. Obviously, other countries like Singapore have adopted other approaches like road user charge, which can be used to essentially control flows. But it's much further along in California. So I think in the meantime, we really need to raise and elevate this conversation to the state level in Sacramento so that there can be the proper mechanisms in place to do that. And at Berkeley, we've been studying this problem for now 10 years, and we're really happy to help. And we're also happy to see what other countries or other cities have done to prevent that problem and how that could apply to Los Angeles.
Mario in the South Bay is a traffic commissioner for a local city, and he says part of the issue is that the app companies don't respond when we tell them we prefer they don't route people through specific neighborhoods. We just get a boilerplate response. We need some sort of regulation so that the companies will listen to us when we raise those issues with them. Mario, thank you very much. I appreciate your sharing that thought with us. You can share your comments throughout the course of the day about Waze and the way it routes people onto residential, often narrow and windy streets in lieu of the freeway or larger thoroughfares. Our thanks to Alexander Bayan of UC Berkeley's Institute of Transportation Studies, Damian Newton, the co-editor of Streets Blog LA, and LA City Councilman Paul Krikorian. Much more to come in our second hour of Air Talk. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Wow, I can't remember the last time that NPR's feed has gone down across the country. We just got confirmation of that. Was nationally NPR's hourly newscast just went out. No one received it across the country. And in fact, all of NPR's content that was streaming out to stations not working for the moment. So hopefully by the noon hour, we'll have that back and operating to bring you national news from NPR. Coming up a little bit later this hour on Air Talk, we'll be taking a look at what Instagram is introducing to Canada. No more likes of content that's posted on Instagram that are going to be able to be seen by general users. So if you post a photo or a video to Instagram in Canada, you'll be able to see how many people end up clicking that they like what you've posted. But no one else is going to be able to see that. The idea, Instagram says, is take away competitive posting where users are trying to build up the number of likes that they get for content. Instagram says instead, this will help people focus on the photos, on the videos themselves. We'll hear what you have to think about it and whether you think that other social media platforms should follow suit and whether Instagram should bring this concept to the United States. But first, though death during childbirth is thankfully rare, complications leading to death are far more common in black women than white expectant mothers. State health researchers say that controlling for socioeconomic factors, the disparity still stands. That's led to the theory that racism, overt or unconscious, is the cause. Setting aside whether that really is the variable that's the reason for that disparity, it's led a couple of state legislators to introduce a bill which would require that health care providers in the state receive training in what's called unconscious bias. This is the idea that people's attitudes they have about others of a given race or ethnicity, they may not even be aware of it, and that that might have a factor with how they would interact with people of those races or ethnicities in the real world. But the research is controversial for a number of reasons that we're going to get into in the course of our program this hour on Air Talk. Joining us to talk about the research and whether implicit bias training is a benefit is Senior Research Associate at Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute, Kelly Capatosto, who is a Senior Research Associate at this institute, which studies race and ethnicity. Thank you very much, Ms. Capatosto, for being with us on Air Talk.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be joining you all today.
Let's start, first of all, with the concept of implicit bias. What does the research show about people's attitude that might be hidden about race or ethnicity affecting how they relate to others in the real world? Does research show that that's a leap that's actually made?
Sure. So, you know, as you said, there's really a lot of nuance in this conversation about implicit bias and how that impacts our perceptions and our actions. And, you know, I could definitely speak to that. But I also kind of want to go back a little bit to, you know, the policy and some of these ramifications as well in this conversation. But yes, implicit bias is one of the many factors in our society that we understand as a source of discrimination. So a lot of this research has really came out in the last decade where, you know, we were in the Obama era. Most of us, you know, a lot of individuals, especially those with privileged identities, were thinking that we were living in a post-racial society, that race didn't matter, that gender didn't matter, and that everyone kind of could pick themselves up by their bootstrap. And where this type of research came in is saying, actually, that's not borne out in the outcomes. That's not borne out in the data whatsoever. We have to think about the opportunities that are present in our society. We have to think about how bias and discrimination are present within our institutions. And implicit bias is just one of those ways that we can understand where that happens on an individual level. Some of the most prominent research, again, showing that is things like resume reviews. So if you're given a resume that has a black versus a white name, your callback rates are going to be different. How we perceive someone's competency, how we perceive someone's credibility is largely determined by our notions of that person's identity and experiences. So in that regard, bias is a very real experience.
That doesn't seem, though, to me like what I would call implicit bias. That sounds like overt racism if people are judging based on someone's name who they think is the stronger candidate. Does that fall under implicit bias?
So certainly a lot of the research is definitely up for debate and something that our institute has been very mindful of in how we have conversations around implicit bias in general, or whether that's automatic, whether it's unconscious. But a lot of the conversations we see being particularly harmful is the ascription to something being implicit or automatic or unintended, when that might not very well be the case at all. It's following this narrative of we tend to give the privilege, we tend to give the benefit of the doubt to those with privileged identities in this space. And we don't know many times when these instances that are happening within the real world are intended or unintended. So, for example, we've seen a lot within the news and the public media around instances of individuals calling the police on Black and Latinos just for simply existing. And a lot of the coverage about that has, you know, really proclaimed these instances as one of implicit bias, as saying those stereotypes are a part of the norm. But in fact, we don't know the intent of the person that's calling the police in those instances. So it's very important to say that, yes, we have research to demonstrate that the concept and the automaticity of our stereotypes are a very real phenomenon. But the application of any of those types of research scenarios to a real world instance, we can't really make that leap. Right? Well, you can't make that leap.
How do you know when someone is testing and revealing certain stereotypical views that it's not revealing sort of someone's familiarity with stereotypes as opposed to what animates their thinking about other people. How do you differentiate that?
Certainly. So, you know, this is, again, part of this debate and part of this conversation. And there, you know, central to this is understanding the different ways that, you know, these implicit associations, that these stereotypes are being tested, and why some of this debate is being centered in this conversation at all. And I think that it's really important that, you know, we talk about the research, we talk about some of this academic debate, but it's important to get back again to the policy itself and why it's important. So, for example, you know, we can get into the nuance of why implicit bias or biases might be unconscious, why they might not be impacting a behavior in any given instance. But when we're talking about policy and legislation like this, it's a really important first step for being that point in that remedy to say that we're not only focusing on explicit or more overt instances of discrimination. We acknowledge that there's a lot of nuance in this conversation. We acknowledge that stereotyping is a part of the human decision-making model. Okay. It is a part of our American fabric. It's a part of the society that we grow up in. And, you know, we could talk about a little bit of, you know, the debate in the literature, but I think that why this is important is because there is that alternative and there is that point where individuals can say, hey, this legislation, this law is acknowledging that there are more subtle forms and more ambiguous forms of racism that have a very real impact in our society.
I guess the question is if you're going to mandate that people have implicit bias training, what is the science behind that? What are you really leading people through? And is it something that's actually going to provide for more equitable treatment of patients regardless of race or ethnicity? We're talking with Ohio State University Senior Research Associate at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, Kelly Capitosto. Her work focuses on implicit bias. Also with us from Harvard University, Professor of Sociology, African American Studies, and European Studies, Michelle Lamont. Professor, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So your thoughts about implicit bias training do we have scientifically strong methods to help people better understand what biases they might have and how that might operate in the real world?
Well, as Kelly mentioned, there's this raging debate in psychology around the value of implicit bias. The questions are what the validity of the test, the degree to which it predicts discriminatory behavior, and the receptivity of implicit bias to different types of intervention. At the same time, as is the case now in California, this is one of the most readily available measures that organizations are using to try to address the challenges that they are encountering with dealing with hiring biases. So it's really being rolled out very, very widely. And what I just described are the internal criticism from within the discipline of psychology. There's also a lot of other criticism that comes from outside. So in sociology, for instance, Frank Dobbin, an organizational sociologist, has data showing that diversity training in general turns people off. And if you want to have a workforce that is more diverse, using mentoring and assessing people on their job description, if it includes hiring a more diverse workforce, is far more effective. With some graduate students, I published a paper in Nature Human Behavior last year, which tackles what some of the other issues with this approach. And the main criticism that we address is that, you know, the basic idea is if you show someone an image of Obama versus Reagan, and you have them associate the word good and bad to those two images, the speed of the let's say Obama bad, will allow people to realize that they are biased even if they think they're not. And one of the criticisms of this method is that it does not take into consideration the relative salience of Obama versus Reagan in the environment of those taking the test. So younger people, for instance, may not know what Reagan looks like, and they know what Obama looks like, and therefore their reaction is faster. And also it doesn't measure the usual exposure to, let's say, people of color in their neighborhood. So in general, the method makes abstraction of the cultural environment in which people live. So that's also a huge challenge. So, you know, many organizations are just using the method as a way to check the box and, frankly, to protect themselves legally to say we've done something. While, in fact, there's many other approaches that are available to create actual real social transformation.
Well, and I guess one of the challenges here is when we're talking about people's racial attitudes and their biases, it is so highly complex and individualized that how do you figure out a way to actually measure what the effect is on the environment? Now, looking at this case of the disparities in mortality rates for expectant mothers, the researchers have done the research. They've sort of said, well, we can't explain this through socioeconomic factors. We control for all that. And we still see this disparity, which is pretty big, between African American and white mothers to be. And so then sort of to fill that gap is, well, it must be because there's racism, or we have these anecdotes of people being treated poorly, terrible things said to them. Therefore, this is racial attitudes that's responsible for that. And then, well, if we can measure racial attitudes, then we can help to address this problem by having people go through. So I guess my question is, it seems to me there are a lot of assumptions that we make along that way, Professor Lamond.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, one approach, of course, would be to train doctors. And I believe the California initiative is just about this. And you can do this by exposing them to the test so that they become aware of their own biases. But you could also explain to them, basically give them basic training in how we have assumptions that African-Americans are poor. While, in fact, the class diversity among African-American has grown a lot. You can also, there's this concept of allostatic load, which basically refers to the wear and tear of everyday life that people experience from exposure to racism and to inequality, and to raise the awareness among doctors about this, but also in transforming the conditions under which people live is also going to create change. So it's not only about influencing the training of doctors, which we know today is extremely insufficient when it comes to their understanding of diversity. You know, the number of hours that they spend studying ethics or even learning basic information about socioeconomic and racial and ethnic diversity of their future patient is just, it would require really a pretty significant transformation of the curriculum of medical school to help them understand better the challenges that their mm-hmm. clients face, to not only focus on the body, but also on the social conditions.
Michelle Lamond with us, Harvard University professor, Kelly Capitosto, Ohio State University senior research associate. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts. If you're someone in your workplace, they have requested you take the implicit bias training and testing, I'd be really interesting to hear what you thought about the experience. Did you feel that you benefited from it? Did you feel in some way it didn't necessarily address what you were hoping it would? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We'll take your calls as we continue on Air Talk in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our focus is on bills in the state legislature, which would mandate that healthcare professionals receive training in implicit bias as a part of their regular licensure. If you're someone who's taken the test, who's gone through that training, you think it'd be beneficial for all healthcare professionals to get that? If you're something who works in the healthcare, or someone who works in the healthcare field, what's your experience of this? Do you think that your colleagues and you personally would benefit from this being mandated? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. David in Baldwin Hills called to say that he was talking with a psychotherapist who said one of the real problems for people who might otherwise seek help is a belief that the implicit bias of a therapist might keep them from truly understanding the circumstance that they would bring into that therapy session. Let's talk with Jerry in Bell. Jerry, have you had experience with this kind of training and testing at your work?
Yes, I most recently took a what's called an unbiased, I guess it's the same category of implicit bias training, where I work at a large corporation. I work in sales. And it was interesting, but what I found was that I actually felt kind of insulted by the whole process, because in sales and in life, I strive to be open-minded and to take every individual as an individual, regardless of what they look like or how tall they are or where they come from or what they speak. And for me, in a nutshell, I would characterize the training as insulting because it presumes bias where there is no bias. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but what the people who back this would say is that all of us have bias. The issue is that we need to be aware of it. Now, it may or may not have an effect on how we treat others. Maybe we are able to deal with everybody as an individual, but that it is still helpful to understand if we have certain unconscious stereotypes that are in mind. Do you think there's any value in knowing that, or do you think that is knowable?
I think it's knowable. I think that people who are generally biased, let's say racist, for example, I don't think this will change their perspective or their particular bent. I think that people who are open-minded and fair and take people as individuals will possibly feel as I do, which was essentially hurt and insulted to presume that I am inherently biased. I mean, of course, when you see a color or you see a or hear a frequency, it gives you a certain sensation, but it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to perceive it like others will perceive it.
Jerry, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. Let me go back to Ohio State University Senior Research Associate Kelly Capitosto with the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. What are some ways that this sort of training attempts to deal with the feeling of insult that Jerry describes, the sort of assumption that people act on whatever is revealed from implicit bias testing?
Yes. So there's actually been a pretty large body of research around using training as a mechanism or as a way to interrupt the expression of bias. And this is really the core question that we should be, you know, talking about that we're addressing today, right? So we can have these conversations of, you know, does bias exist? Does stereotyping exist in our society? And I think that for the most part, you know, a lot of us can agree, but it's really about this theory of change, right? So if bias is present, is training an effective mechanism for reducing the effects of those biases? And I would say that there really isn't enough evidence of that, because as the caller demonstrated and as the research demonstrated, that creates a lot of resistance, that creates a lot of disbelief, and that's just a very normal experience for those of us that have privileged identities and revealing something to us that we don't think aligns with our character. So if, you know, training isn't a very helpful way of changing attitudes, what should legislation be doing, or how can we move further to make the trainings more helpful and more impactful? So, for example, there's been legislation that's been introduced in Grand Rapids that is addressing this question of, you know, individuals calling the police for just existing while black. So they're creating an economic incentive of saying that, you know, if you're calling the police on someone with a marginalized identity and there is no crime in fact happening, then there's going to be a fine. right? So how do we couple this knowledge that stereotyping and implicit bias is a part of our society and make that really a question of our institutions rather than the individual? Because we're not going to create that individual level change if people are not really grappling with this concept in the way that it's supposed to be grappled with, and if they're taking that information and having a lot of negative reactions to it. But there are certainly ways to move forward. It's just really about, you know, how can we move beyond just training and awareness orientation to thinking about what we're calling bias-conscious policymaking? How can we understand bias as a part of our status quo, as a part of our society that has a very, very real impact regardless of whether it's explicit, overt, or right, you know, implicit or kind of ambiguous or unconscious?
I need to conclude there because our line with you is going to go away in just seconds. Kelly Capitosto, thank you so much. Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, Professor Michelle Lamont, Professor of Sociology, African American Studies, and European Studies at Harvard University, joining us as well. You can share your comments about whether medical professionals should be mandated to have unconscious bias training and testing on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. The California Public Records Act allows for members of the public to be able to request emails or other documents from public colleges and universities where there's a question of the public about, you know, what's going on. This is something that was established to allow for transparency in government, but it also applies to higher education in California when it's a public school setting. But there's a bill in Sacramento which would shield higher education, specifically research that's being done there, from some of the same broad requirements for openness under the California Public Records Act. Now, several states already exclude public universities from public records laws. Here in California, if this bill passes, it would, with its extensive higher education network, make it the most far-reaching such limitation in the country. With us, Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, sponsor of AB 700, Michael Halpern. Mr. Halpern, thank you for being with us. Why do public colleges and universities need these exemptions from the Public Records Act?
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be with you. I want to make sure that people don't necessarily, and you don't think that this is the most far-reaching proposal out there. There are a lot of states that have different public records laws of varying permissiveness. And we definitely all agree that universities should not be exempt from these laws, right? We think that it's important for the public to be able to understand when there's sexual harassment or research misconduct or other kinds of improper influence on the work of people who work for public universities. So what we're focused on protecting here is the research process itself, not published research or data, but the research process from excessive disclosure that really provides very little public benefit while creating significant impediments to the ability of scientists and other academics to pursue really critical policy relevant questions. What we've found is that there are some companies and some activists that are exploiting these laws to try to find something that they can use to confuse the public about research that they don't like. Whether it's climate scientists or public health researchers or toxicologists, a lot of them have been needlessly attacked because the way in which researchers communicate with each other and test out ideas has fundamentally changed, and the nation's Public Records Act, public records laws just haven't caught up.
Well, won't researchers, though, get used to that how they communicate with their peers elsewhere or members of their team, that is all a public record? They would keep that in mind when they do that. Could they not just make that a part of how they go about their work?
Well, certainly they've become a lot more sophisticated in how they use email and communicate with each other. But the fact is that scientists used to test out new ideas with each other at scientific meetings, around the water cooler at the lab, you know, over the phone. And, you know, the advent of email fundamentally changed how scientists communicate and created this extensive written record of new ideas. And that's a great thing. It allows a scientist in California to work with someone in Australia or Michigan, and, you know, creates a lot of efficiencies. But we all need private space to be able to test out new ideas. There's a significant public cost when we don't feel free to challenge each other. And if, you know, take it to another industry, you know, think about it, Larry, if you and other staff on the show had to publish all of your background notes, all of your drafts, all of your sources with their contact information whenever you went on the air, very few people would talk to you. Very few people would communicate with you openly. Everything that was off the record would be out the window. And in a similar vein, you know, I think it's not right to set this up as this irreconcilable fight between protecting the public research process and advocating for transparency. We have to figure out and really look at what's in the public interest to be able to disclose and what should be made private.
We're talking with Michael Halpern of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's deputy director of the Union Center for Science and Democracy. The union is a sponsor of AB 700, which would exempt the release of information relating to a researcher or her or his work in higher education. It would include public colleges and universities here in California. In a moment, we'll talk with the ACLU of California's legislative director Kevin Baker. He'll share with us his concerns about exempting researchers from California's Public Record Acts. This enables news media, members of the public, or researchers to be able to gain information about communications at public entities. That includes public higher education. We'll continue that conversation coming right up here on Air Talk. And then a little bit later this hour, we'll talk about how Instagram in Canada is going to shield the likes for postings of photos and video, with the idea that it'll get people out of that competitive posting, trying to amass as many likes as possible. We'll talk about whether that'd be a good idea for other social media platforms to bring to the U.S. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Should California's public colleges and universities, their researchers, be exempt from California's Public Records Act? Does the act and its assurance of allowing public disclosure of all kinds of research communications get in the way of researchers being able to do their best work? Does it tie them up cost-wise and time-wise in having to provide all kinds of documentation, which is not truly for a public benefit, but ends up aiding particular interest groups? Joining us to talk about concerns over a bill that would exempt public colleges and universities is ACLU Legislative Director of California, Kevin Baker. Mr. Baker, thank you for being with us. What are your concerns about exempting researchers at California public schools of higher ed?
Well, thanks very much, Larry. The legislation that we're talking about would change the California Public Records Act, and that's the state version of the federal law that many people may be more familiar with, which is the Freedom of Information Act. The Public Records Act reflects a fundamental principle of democracy. In order for the government to be reflective of and responsive to the will of the people, the public must be allowed to know what the government is up to and, of course, what is being conducted with our tax dollars. So it's not just a good idea. It's actually built into the state constitution as a core principle. And our public colleges and universities have never been exempted from this fundamental principle. And, of course, I think most people would believe that we have some of the best public universities in the country, if not in the world. So I don't think that there's anything inconsistent between good research and public accountability.
If you have a particular interest group, though, that is, you know, wanting to shut down a certain avenue of research or find ways it can publicly criticize in a way of sort of harassing those researchers, for lack of a better term, by requesting voluminous documents of what may be a years-long project. How does that not get in the way of what the researchers are doing? I mean, just to comply with the law, you have considerable person hours and costs that can be involved in each of those requests.
Well, there may in fact be some process or transaction cost to the Public Records Act, and that is really a fundamental feature of transparency. But folks should understand how this law works. It's not the case that anyone can submit a Public Records Act request and, you know, voluminous documents are necessarily turned over. These are decided on sort of a case-by-case basis. The university reviews and makes a determination about what is public and what is not. There are existing exceptions. The way the law deals with this issue now is a balancing test. It looks at what is the nature of the request, what are the documents that are responsive to that request, and what are the public interests in disclosure or the public interest in non-disclosure. And the court makes that decision on a case-by-case basis. So in many situations, maybe thousands of pages might have been, or thousands of documents might have been requested, but the court will only allow a limited number of those. And that's the way the system is supposed to work. The problem is that you can't take the Public Records Act out of the hands of those who use it for purposes you disapprove of without also extinguishing the rights of those who use the Public Records Act in the public interest to uncover any number of wrongs. For example, the LA Times had a story recently regarding a University of Massachusetts professor who got a lot of corporate grant money to fund his controversial theory that toxic chemicals and radiation are actually good for us. The Times uncovered emails showing how he had been collaborating with the Trump administration to weaken environmental pollution rules. And that's the kind of story that would never have come out if university emails were a secret, as they would be under this bill.
We're talking with the ACLU Legislative Director Kevin Baker in opposition to Assembly Bill 700, which would exempt researchers in California public colleges and universities from having to provide documents under the California Public Records Act. Michael Halpern of the Union of Concerned Scientists, your response to Kevin Baker's argument that this would do more harm than good.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, he's a bit exaggerating kind of the scope of this particular legislation. We're looking at protecting communications between scientists, not between scientists and the Trump administration or scientists and corporations or other ways in which scientists are either being used for independent veneer or any other kind of influence. The idea of the balancing test, the idea that every single request should go to some kind of balancing test just isn't practical or efficient. Why would we want to tie up thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours of employee resources if we can agree that things like peer review comments among researchers and unpublished data and the drafts of research papers that scientists are challenging each other are just not inherently ready for prime time and therefore shouldn't be disclosed? We're looking at a very narrow exemption to the Public Records Act to be able to make that system more efficient, because we want professors to be spending more time with students and to be sharing their work with the public and policymakers and to be collecting more data on climate change, on toxic chemicals, on the impact of guns on or ammunition on endangered species and so on and so forth. And I think we agree with the ACLU on a whole lot of topics, including the right to privacy. And I know that the ACLU argues that it wants to ensure that civil liberties are enhanced by technology rather than compromised by it. The fact is that a lot of, these conversations that used to happen between scientists on the phone or in person are now happening via email. And that has a lot of advantages, but it also makes it much more easy for people to be tracked and companies and governments to cherry pick and go on fishing expeditions to undermine policy-relevant research.
I need to wrap, but I want to thank you both, Michael Halpern, Union of Concerned Scientists Deputy Director, Kevin Baker, Legislative Director, ACLU of California. Coming up on Air Talk, Instagram in Canada is going to shield likes for the general public, so only the poster, him or herself, will see how many likes a particular photo or video has garnered. Whole idea, Instagram says, sort of cut down on the competition for likes. The idea is to raise the appreciation for simply the photo or video itself, as opposed to the rush to get approval. We'll see what you think about that in 1 minute. I love those spots John Raby puts together with all the breaking news covered here at KPCC. Sort of a reminder even to those who work here, wow, a lot's happened within a week or two period of time. Instagram, for its Canadian users of the photo and video platform, is going to shield likes from the general public, from other users. Only the person who posts photos or video are going to see for themselves how many people like the posting, but it's not going to be visible to everybody else. What does this mean for influencers, people who are looking to try and build the greatest number of followers and people liking the content that they put up? Would this really do, as Instagram has mentioned, take away from the sort of competitive posting that goes on now and make it about the photos or videos themselves instead of just the people that are posting? With us, Ashley Carman, tech reporter for The Verge, who's following the story. Ashley, thank you for joining us. Have any other social media platforms considered this in certain markets, shielding this kind of feedback?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. So just to, you know, from the onset to say, it's going to be optional for Instagram users. It's not going to affect the entire platform. It's something that users in Canada can opt into where they want to hide their likes. And I'm trying to think, I mean, a lot of the most popular social platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat doesn't do likes, so that's a little bit different. It's more of a messaging app. But those apps, they do have likes, and that's a big part of why people use them, is to get that feedback loop of they want to feel good. They're posting content. They're getting feedback back, and it makes you want to keep posting.
All right. Ashley, thanks for laying that out. Also with us, Karen North, USC Annenberg School of Communications, expert in social media and psychology and professor of communication. Karen, good to have you with us again. Do you think this is going to have an impact on the people that are the heaviest users, the people who take pride in being influencers?
Yeah, thanks, Larry, for having me back. You know, of course it will have a huge impact on these people, and not only on the influencers who are looking to engage their audiences and their, you know, their followers, but also on the followers who want to participate in a shared social activity of engaging with these influencers.
One of our producers was mentioning in our morning meeting that, you know, if she didn't see other people who were liking something that she, you know, thought was particularly interesting, she might be hesitant to put a like on it, that there is that sort of a community impact. And it does seem there's sort of a human nature of, you know, sort of what you see other members of the pack doing. Is that going to mean overall fewer people like something?
We don't know, but that certainly is the speculation. I mean, you know, Instagram is the land of what we would call social comparison. We look for role models to do things, and we look to see what everybody else is doing, and we want to join in. And so if we don't see the likes happening, if we don't see the community, the sense of community or the social activity of liking and joining together, it won't cue us. It won't give us the social cues to do it. And, you know, and that's really, it's fun for people to do that, and it's fun for people to like something and then see that their friends like it, and especially that other influencers, people they follow, like it. It makes them feel close, like, oh, look, that person and I and all these other people share an interest and we have a camaraderie. And that could be taken away with this move.
Sasha Strauss, a brand management expert who we frequently have on the program, was talking with one of our producers about this and saying that one of the things behind this is that Instagram is looking at sort of transforming itself from a social media site to a broadcast media channel where the production quality is highlighted, where it's sort of all about the content as opposed to the interaction. Karen, do you think that that is going to be effective, or do you think that that might be a miscalculation, Instagram not understanding what makes it popular?
Or what makes it unique and special, right? So, ever since the phenomenal success of Netflix, everybody's tried to get into the content production and broadcast game, and it doesn't necessarily work for everybody. So Instagram has been pretty effective at copying features from other platforms, especially Snapchat. But if they want to do that, they have to realize that each of these networks, the truly successful ones, the Instagrams and the Twitters, have their own audiences and their own sort of social standards and social patterns. And taking away what is one of the fundamental activities of Instagram to become something else isn't necessarily the right move, because they don't know if their users are going to follow in that way.
He also made the, Sasha Strauss also made the point that Instagram is going more toward this curated content where brands and their influencers are trying to sell stuff. It's product promotion, which apparently has brought in a lot of revenue. So then are people going to see this as not being a place where they necessarily want to put their personal photos or videos?
Well, I mean, the other take on that is that, what people love about Instagram on the product side is they love the feeling that they have a personal connection with these influencers. They have a personal connection with these celebrities. And then when the celebrities talk about products, we all feel like they're sort of whispering to us and showing us inside of their lives. But if it becomes a brand-oriented promotion or promotional device, or a curated entertainment device with a lot of, basically endorsements, then it takes away that personal feeling that, we're there to communicate with our friends and hang out with our friends, and among our friends are these influencers who are endorsed by brands. It'll just be another content site.
We're talking with USC Annenberg Professor of Communications Karen North, an expert in social media and psychology who joins us frequently to talk about these very issues. I'd love to hear your thoughts if you're an Instagram user. Again, this only affects Canada, and as we heard from The Verge tech reporter Ashley Carman, it's an opt-in to this shielding of likes. But would you like to see this come to the U.S., or do you think that it would fundamentally remove what you find an appealing quality of Instagram, that ability to see how many other individuals have liked a particular photo or video that's been posted? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Karen, I don't know if there's a particular benefit to Snap in this, if Snapchat is the biggest competitor to Instagram or not, but do you think there might be other people with competing platforms kind of licking their chops over this?
I mean, right now Snap has had the problem that Instagram keeps copying their features. So if they then shift away, it may leave an opening. But let me also comment, just because you kind of half raised this issue, and it's a great issue. People love joining in on a cause. And one thing that Instagram's been really successful at is having these sort of broad mass appeal causes like World Record Egg. Let's see how many people in the world will join together in a common fun activity. Or, if we get enough likes, we will donate a service animal to a vet or plant a tree. And if you take away the likes, which currently in the test is opt-in, but they're testing it to decide whether or not, where to go with it. But it takes away the fun of joining these big, activities.
All right. Mohammed in Mid-City, L.A. says, without the public display of likes, it would decrease insecurity in people. It's a good thing. And Mohammed's point, this is exactly what Instagram says, that it's looking at, sort of moving out of this where people are competing to see who can get the most likes. Ian in Los Feliz, what do you think?
Yeah, hi, Larry. As a social media manager, I think that from a marketing perspective, the option of excluding likes is a good thing because it'll give me a more organic idea of who's actually liking that content as opposed to people just scrolling down the feed and slamming the like button based on previous likes.
So you're going to get us because you're going to see what the likes are if this came to the U.S. and you opted in. But people wouldn't be doing it just to follow the lead of others. That's interesting. So it could give you more valuable data about what you're posting. Might it also, though, inhibit something that could take off otherwise?
Yeah, there's always the catch.
Yeah. All right. Ian is a social media manager. I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Dimitri in Irvine says, I'm a photographer in 3D media. We use Instagram for my business. I often see terrible quality professional pics, and I think the quality will go up if the likes go away. That's funny, Dimitri. All right. I appreciate it very much. And USC Annenberg Professor Karen North, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Larry. Always.
Thank you. Karen North, USC Annenberg School of Communication. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is coming up next. I know you give her plenty of likes. She's going to be talking with journalist Oliver Bullo about his new book on oligarchs, kleptocrats, and crooks, how they hide their ill-gotten fortunes around the world. Have a great afternoon.